As always, it's wonderful to sit together with you, to open my eyes and see your faces. So today we get to reflect on Parsha Ki Tisah, often known as the Torah reading about the golden calf. And after the awesome earth-shaking experience of revelation at Mount Sinai, an experience that overwhelmed and confused the senses, Moses leaves the Israelites for 40 days. Initially, Moses, Aaron, Nadav, Avihu, and 70 of the elders go up the mountain together. They beheld God, they ate and drank, which is interesting to imagine. And then God invites Moses to come up to the mountain and to leave the others behind. Moses, attended by Joshua, says to the elders, "Wait here for us until we return to you. You have Aaron and Hur with you. Let anyone who has a legal matter approach them." In retrospect, we can see a failure in Moses' understanding of what he means to the Israelites. He assigns to Aaron and Hur his legal authority without seeming to recognize that the Israelites depend on him for so many other aspects of leadership and survival, not just deciding legal matters, but also spiritual guidance, inspiration, protection, security, hope, survival, miracles. Aviva Zornberg points out that Moses was himself related to almost like an idol whom these desperate, traumatized refugees had come to worship. She points out that Moses was a step between God and the golden calf. In the absence of Moses as a sign of strength and protection, as a source of shining light, the Israelites become desperate for another shiny symbol of strength that they could put their faith in. Once their longing for faith had been aroused by all the miracles, once they had risked their lives to leave their homes because of their faith in Moses and his God, they now had no object to invest with their faith that they could see. They couldn't relate to something that they perceived as absent at the end of 40 days. So Moses seemed to give no attention to the accommodations he would need to make to reassure these refugees that he had not led them into the desert just to die for no reason. So no wonder the Israelites panic and beg for material reassurance that we have not been abandoned to die in a scary wilderness. Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh brought us out of Mizraim, which Shefa Gold in Torah Journeys describes as a place of narrow perception. Mizraim, using the understanding of Tzar, a narrow place, she describes this as a place of narrow perception. And she describes our freedom in contrast as conscious connection to the reality that lies beneath the surface of things, that allows us to expand beyond the arbitrary limits of our particular conditioned perspective. Our experience at Sinai was that teaching moment when we were emotionally open to receiving the message, but also terrified and blown back by it. And then after that, life, which is scary, leads us into our naturally kind of preoccupied state of being preoccupied with self-preservation. So we need to be able to access reminders about the illusory nature of our separateness so that we can keep reconnecting with this holy relationship. So even as God is transmitting Torah to Moses on the mountain, and God is giving instructions for us to build the Mishkan, this portable sanctuary, so we can create a portable space where we can access our holy relationship to the oneness of all things. Even as this is happening, that the Israelites are feeling desperate for this connection. And this is how we understand the well-known words in Parshat Truma, the Torah reading from a couple of weeks ago, "Let them build me a sanctuary so I may dwell among or within them." God is letting us know that with the right process and structure, we can create a space in our lives and our communities for connection with this sense of oneness and wonder that lifts us out of this narrow perception. But before Moses has time to get back, the people have grown desperate. His absence left an unbearable void. So an unbearable sense of emptiness and void. And they cried out to fill that emptiness with an image that would comfort them. What, you might wonder, is wrong with the golden calf? God was intending to have them be a Mishkan anyway, to be the center of their worship. What's wrong with building a golden calf rather than this portable ark with all its golden accoutrements? So Rabbi Gold offers us a way to understand what's different about the golden calf, our exemplary idol, and exactly what we're not supposed to worship, and what's different between that and the sanctuary, which is designated for worship. The Mishkan, she explains, exists for the space within it. Great attention is put into the details of the structure that contain a holy emptiness, a place that's left open and spacious so that the presence of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh can dwell within the community, where we can connect to the divine spark within us. And in contrast, the golden calf is solid. We supply the gold, but then the calf seems to take on a life of its own. As Aaron says, "I cast the gold into the fire and out came this calf." And before, when I read this, I thought of this as a kind of lame excuse. But in my current reading, I see how it reflects a sense of loss of control. The people and Aaron, along with them, were swept into something that took on a life and power of its own, a desperate wish to be saved from abandonment in the wilderness, a wish for a savior so strong that it overtook them and produced the illusion of a savior leaping out of the flames. And it's an idol because we're worshiping something that has a material presence and as such cannot be enduring. Everything that arises passes. The Mishkan represents a space in which we're guided to connect with the inner essence, the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh that dwells within us. The idol is the golden calf who leaps to fill a terrifying void left by Moses. And the Mishkan is a structure that contains a different kind of emptiness, an emptiness that offers us a conduit to connect with a bigger perspective, a way of feeling connected with reality as it unfolds in each moment. And I find this explanation particularly fitting for our meditation group, as our practice treats the body and the form of sitting meditation as a Mishkan, a structure in which there's space to connect with whatever arises as we tune into reality unfolding in each moment. We may feel that some forms of meditation practice do make idols out of the form of practice rather than using the form to access spaciousness. Any practice can become an idol depending on how we relate to it. Any ritual. Hopefully, in our practice, we recognize that the feeling of being attracted to and needing something material to idolize, to cherish, it could be the longing we feel in any of our addictive behaviors, the longing for a certain kind of fame or recognition, something material. As long as we can use the practice to create space to hold that feeling, to be in touch with that longing for an idol as it rises and falls without acting on it, without getting up to run after that thing, then we are using the practice as a Mishkan and not running after a golden calf. Rabbi Alan Liu gives us another layer of commentary on the odd and confusing structure of the five Torah readings that follow the giving of Torah at Mount Sinai. He explains that these five readings are structured in the literary form of a chiasmus. And this is, I think, from Renaissance literature, I'm not sure. But the first and last lines are parallel. The second to the last lines are parallel. And they make a concentric structure which creates a space into the center that we enter into and emerge from. And there are other examples, like in the first verses of Va'era, God communicates to Moses in the form of a chiasmus. And actually, I'm going to share the screen here because it's easier to see if I just show you. So, this is the chiasmus. I am Adonai, verse A. I appeared to your forebears, verse B. I made my covenant with them. C. I heard the cries of the Israelites and remembered my covenant. And then at the center, I will deliver you from bondage and redeem you. And then we go back to D, to the covenant. You will know that I am your God who releases you. C, I'll give you the land I promised you in the covenant. B, that I promised to your forebears. A, I am Adonai. And then he goes on to say that the five Torah readings that we read, Truma, this is what you're going to build. Tetzava, here are all the implements and accessories that you need. This is God instructing Moses. Kitisa, this is the empty space in the middle with the longing for the golden calf or connection to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh can take place, the terrifying void or the sacred emptiness. And then coming out of it, Vayakel describes how the service will be done in the Mishkan in according with the instructions given in Tetzeva. And Pekodeh is an accounting of all the materials that were brought together as gifts in Truma. So that's the chiasmus. Two Parshiot about form and structure lead into the holy emptiness. And two Parshiot lead out of it. And in the middle, there's the terror, the longing, the passion, the repair, and the reconnection. And we are invited into that empty space to connect with the spaciousness in each of us. As Yocheved often says, the Torah is always giving us instructions for practice. And these five Parshiot tell us how to set up a structure, enter into it, and emerge from it. So that's more than enough for us to talk about this week. But I also wanted to talk about something, an idea that I heard in a talk by Norman Fisher that was about ancient Buddhist teachings. And that highlighted for me a question about a real difference that we perceive and often struggle with between Buddhist and Jewish teachings. So in a Dharma talk that I heard on his Everyday Zen website, about the writings of Shantideva, Norman ended by saying, there's a very important point that's not often made. Ancient Buddhist teachings developed in a context in which it was taken for granted that life is terrible hardship. Everyone suffered. The feudal system did not offer any political freedoms or path to change. And since it was impossible to better one's material circumstances, all the focus of the teachings were on how we transform ourselves to experience even inner freedom, even when we're in terrible circumstances. So all the focus is on the transformation of our inner life, not on bettering our external or political conditions. It's not about social justice. Because there was no hope of that. Probably your best bet was to get to a monastery and to hope that no one would bother you there while you and your fellow monks tilled the soil to feed yourselves. In contrast, in today's world, we do have hope for improving our outer conditions, for material betterment, for political change that can hopefully bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice, as Dr. King said. Today, fortunately, it's actually worthwhile to explore whether we can be happier if we change our material circumstances. There's hope for getting a better job, a more compatible partner, fighting oppression, working toward moral justice. But in many cases, we can make these changes that do make us happier. But they don't always. So today, we can overlook the inner transformation as we pursue external changes. And the risk is that even with a better job, a new partner, more money, or whatever, our old patterns make us unhappy, and our old patterns persist if we do not give any attention to the transformation of our inner life. Our modern heroes like Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King did both during their time in prison and under oppression. They worked on inner transformation. At the same time, they worked toward changing outer circumstances. Now, when we teach from Buddhist texts, it seems foolhardy to focus only on inner transformation. In contrast, ancient Jewish teachings, like the story of Exodus, seem to communicate hope of material change for those who are depressed. Depressed and oppressed. The story tells us we can be liberated from Pharaoh if we struggle with the internal, external world, but only if we also align ourselves with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Only if we also work on our inner transformation. Now, I'm not familiar enough with the political and historical circumstances in which ancient Jewish and Buddhist teachings arose, and whether there are historical and political reasons for this different emphasis on inner and outer change. But just thinking about these differences helped me to understand why so often the Buddhist teachings seem to ignore the quality of our lives in the material world. And Jewish teachings are, in contrast, quite clear about what one needs in order to live in harmony with others in the community and in order to have a better life. There is a big emphasis on awareness of our obligations as members of a community to respect each other, to have laws and systems of justice. So I bring this up perhaps as a helpful way to understand some of the contrasts in how Jewish and Buddhist teachings balance that tension between improving one's inner and one's outer circumstances. And I welcome your insights and discussions. So we can.